Morning. Everybody. I think we must start because the time will be against us. First, let me take this opportunity to welcome everybody in the meeting, the special delegates from the provinces. I see Free State and Eastern Cape. Thank you very much. Also, the honorable members, the department. This was a short notice, but due to the time frame, we don't have time for these bills. We need to have the briefings and also the provinces to have their briefings. So sorry for this. And as a result, I said to the officials that they must be very quick to brief us because honorable members by 12 o'clock should be out of this room because they are rushing for the planes. So I think we must do like that. Before I start the meeting, let me introduce myself. Maybe there are those who don't know me. I am Nolthando Qikani from the Eastern Cape, the chairperson of this committee. Honorable West.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, everyone. My name is Daryl Worth, and I'm a member of this select committee, and I'm from the Free State Province.
No, my name is Kaska Mugitlani. I'm from the Free State Legislature.
Thanks, Chairperson. The name is Nombula Pongo from Eastern Cape.
Morning, everybody. Ashka Bawa, Committee Secretary. Thank you.
Morning. My name is Deshni Palek. I'm the content advisor.
I must have it from this side, from the officials. Everybody must introduce him or herself, please.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Tamim Donzwa. I'm the Deputy Chief Land Claims Commissioner from the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform.
Morning, Chair, honorable members and colleagues. My name is Ralph Sebi Fello, Parliamentary Liaison Officer for the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members. My name is Tsepo Mashaela, Chief Director of Legal Services for the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members. My name is Alf Wills. I'm DDG in the Department of Environmental Affairs.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. I'm Linda Garlip. I'm Chief Director, Law Reform and Appeals.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Mark Gordon. I'm the Deputy Director General from the Department of Environmental Affairs.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members. My name is Isham Abada. I'm also a DDG at Environmental Affairs.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. I'm Sibongiseni Sangu, the Director in the Office of the DG, Environmental Affairs.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Dennis Tupan, and I'm working for CNC, a public affairs agency.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Suan Aji. I'm the parliamentary legal advisor.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Vyoga Zinwabozi. I'm the parliamentary legal advisor.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Kurt Mussolini from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group. I'm the monitor today.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members and colleagues. My name is Palesa Lesabe. I'm from the Northwest Provincial Legislature, the committee administrator. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members, colleagues. My name is Portia Kuno. I'm the committee coordinator, Free State Legislature. Thank you.
Morning. I'm Philip Mahova, Limpopo NCOP admin officer. Thank you.
morning, Fenita Abrams, Northern Cape, MCLP.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. I'm Chris Crozier from Rhodesia.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Christopher, and I'm from 7-8.
Foster Mohalley, Parliament, Media and Liaison Office.
Morning, everyone. My name is Nwethu Swa Mayambela, Western Cape Liaison Officer. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Juan Holiday. I'm serving a member in this committee.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Sitabi Subawa, committee assistant.
Thank you very much. I've got some couple of apologies. Honorable Zulu, Bambe, Honorable Mkhoro, Makadla, Honorable Makubele, Honorable Dibia Isik, and also Honorable Ntwanambe. There's also a apologies from the Minister, the Deputy Minister, and the DG, the Department of Rural Development. In our agenda, we'll go straight to our agenda. We're going to hear a briefing by the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform on the restitution of Land Rights Amendment B35B 2013, Section 76. Over to you, Department.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members and colleagues. Good morning once again. Tamim Donzo is my name. I'm a Deputy Land Claims Commissioner. We are taking the committee through the Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill. In terms of the presentation outline on slide number two, we will just briefly revisit where the restitution program comes from, a review of the program that was done by the department, highlights from the regulatory impact assessments, the policy reforms that have resulted from the review and the regulatory impact assessment, the provisions of the bill, implications of the bill at an organizational level, implications for communication, and just a brief overview of the consultations that have already been undertaken. On slide number three, we set out the overview of the restitution program. Restitution emanates from Section 25(7) of the Constitution, and there is a Restitution of Land Rights Act. It's a 1994 Act which provides for the qualification criteria, who qualifies for restitution. It also regulates the restitution process itself. The Restitution Act establishes the Commission on Restitution of Land Rights and the Land Claims Court. The Commission has a mandate of soliciting claims, investigating them, and attempting to resolve them through mediation and negotiation. And the Land Claims Court is a specialist court that adjudicates on disputes arising from the restitution program. In terms of who qualifies for restitution, it is a person or a direct descendant of a person or an estate or a community that was dispossessed of a right in land after 19 June 1913 as a result of past racially discriminatory laws or practices, and such a person or community must have lodged a claim by 31 December 1998. There are two cut-off dates that are applicable in the restitution program. The first one is the 19 June 1913 cut-off date. That is the date that the Native Land Act came into effect, and the Constitution then made provisions in 25(7) that only those whose land rights were dispossessed after 19 June 1913 would be competent to get restitution. The second cut-off date relates to the lodging of a claim with the Commission. The cut-off date was 31 December 1998. The Department of Rural Development and Land Reform was established in 2009, and it took over the work of the Department of Land Affairs. It had a new mandate, so all policies and legislation and implementation models of land affairs had to be aligned to the new mandate of the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. For this purpose, then, the department published a green paper on land reform in 2011. One of the challenges that were identified in the green paper was that a restrictive restitution model. We arrived at this conclusion after having conducted the review of the program, which was carried by the department, with stakeholders, and through interactions with beneficiaries in provincial and national workshops. The national workshop was attended by 1,296 beneficiaries of restitution. All of these people had lodged their claims and they had benefited from the restitution program. They were asked to evaluate the impact of the program, and one of the challenges that they identified was that there were deserving people that did not participate in the programs. Those were people who did not lodge their claims by the cut-off date of 31 December 1998, people who lost their land before 19 June 1913. And then in the case of the Eastern Cape, there were communities that were dispossessed by the implementation of betterment planning policies who were excluded by the white paper on South African land policy in 1997. The reasons that we were given by those who did not lodge claims are that the research methodology that informed the design of the restitution program was poor. Dispossessions took place in a period of 350 years, and yet people were only given 3 years within which to lodge their claims. That the window period that was provided was too short, and the communication campaign did not reach every corner of the country. Many of the people informed government that they didn't even know about restitution or a requirement that a claim must be lodged. They said that the verification systems of the commission are poor, and that the communities are dispossessed because of betterment planning policies, especially in the Eastern Cape, were excluded. We then conducted the regulatory impact assessment. The RIA identified two options that are available to government at policy level. The first option was to retain the 1998 cut-off date for restitution, and the second option was to reopen the lodgement of claims by those who did not claim by the 31st of December 1998. The impact assessment then recommended the reopening of lodgement of claims. We had also asked that we look at the possible number of claims that are likely to be lodged, and the RIA arrived at a conclusion that approximately 397,000 valid claims will be lodged. That is a five-fold increase to the current to the claims that were lodged by 31 December 1998, and they estimated that it would cost between 129 to 179 billion rands, depending on the options that will be selected by the claimants and if the claims are settled within a period of 15 years. The department, the regulatory impact assessment in terms of presidency guidelines must be undertaken by independent parties. The view of the department is that it would be difficult to quantify the number of claims to be lodged, because we noted what the estimates in the RIA were, but we just don't know, and we don't think there is a mechanism of actually getting to the number of claims to be lodged until such time that they are lodged. So the same goes for financial implications. We can have one claim, we can have a million claims, so we will only really know what the actual implications will be once the claims are lodged. In the 2013 State of the Nation address, the President announced that there were proposed amendments to the Restitution Act to provide for the reopening of claims by the people who missed the 31 December 1998 deadline. He also announced that also to be explored are exceptions to the June 1913 cut-off date to accommodate the descendants of the Khoi and Sen, as well as heritage sites and historical landmarks. Now, this bill, the Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill, proposes the amendment of the Restitution Act to provide for the reopening of lodgement of claims for a period of 5 years. Initially, it was an open-ended a process where people could come at any time, and then at some point before consultations by government, the period was 10 years, and then after the consultation, it was reduced to 5 years. Now we are still, as a department, working with the COI and SEN representatives, are developing a policy on the exceptions to the 1913 Natives Land Act cut-off date, and that work is ongoing. So this bill just addresses the issue of those who did not lodge their claims by 31 December 1998, and the cut-off date of 19 June 1913. A policy is being developed on that part. If we then look at the bill itself, Clause 1 of the bill amends Section 21E of the Restitution Act. That is the section that requires that a claim must be lodged not later than the 31st of December 1998. The amendment there is to then substitute 31 December 1998 with 30 June 2019. That is a five-year lodgement period. The second clause of the bill makes an insertion in Section 6 of the Act, providing for a mandatory prioritization of claims lodged not later than 31 December 1998, which will not be finalized on the date that the bill is signed into law. We still have 8,733 claims that remain outstanding, so that provision is made to ensure that those people that have been waiting for their claims to be finalized since 1998, that those claims will be prioritized for settlement. There is also an insertion in Section 6, which is a requirement that the Commission must establish a national restitution register. That register will then have details of the claims, details of the properties that have been claimed, so that both claimants and current owners of land can actually inquire and find out from the department whether there are claims on their land. The access to this national restitution register will be governed by the Promotion of Access to Information Act of 2000. Clause 3 of the bill amends Section 11(1) of the Restitution Act. Section 11(1) provides for a process that must be followed when you are after you have accepted a claim. Currently, it requires that you must make it known in the district where the land is that there is a claim on the piece of land. The amendment is for that information to be made available nationally and to be published in the media circulating nationally in the province and in the district, because in some instances people were removed, for instance, from Port Elizabeth to Cape Town. So if we only make it known in Port Elizabeth that there is a claim, people who may have an interest outside of Port Elizabeth will not have access to that information. Clause 4 of the bill is a consequential amendment. There are quite a number of sections in the Restitution Act that makes reference to the cut-off date for lodging a claim. Every time in the Restitution Act, 31 December 1998 appears, it is being substituted by 30 June 2019. Clause 5 of the bill amends Section 17 of the Act. Section 17 provides for offences. Two new offences are being created. The first one is where a person unlawfully prevents another person from pursuing his or her rights provided for in the Act. So it's unlawful to stop a claimant from wanting to go and claim restitution. There's also a new offence that is being created, making it an offence for a person who lodges a claim with an intention to defraud the state. Those will be people who know that they were never removed from a particular place, but they lodge a claim. And if the National Prosecuting Authority can prove that it was the intention of the person to defraud the state, then they will be charged with the crime of fraud. Clause 6 of the bill deals with judges in the Land Claims Court. As we said earlier, the Land Claims Court was established by the Restitution Act. It was meant to be a temporary court. It was established in 1994. So many of the provisions relating to judges and their appointment are not aligned to the current manner in which judges are appointed. And in consultation with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, we then proposed that we must align the processes and benefits that accrue to judges with those of the High Court. The Land Claims Court also has the status of the High Court. The new sections in that are proposed in Clause 6 of the bill states that the Land Claims Court shall consist of a judge president and as many judges as may be determined by the president. That is in line with other High Courts. The judges will be appointed from judges of the High Court. So, to be a judge in the Land Claims Court, you must first qualify to be a judge of the High Court. Judges will be appointed for a period that is fixed by the president, and they will remain as judges of the Land Claims Court for as long as they remain judges of the High Court. Acting judges are to be appointed by the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development. In the current Restitution Act, even acting judges are required to be appointed by the President, which is something that doesn't happen elsewhere. Clause 7 of the bill then deals with transitional arrangements. There are judges, there are two sitting judges of the Land Claims Court who, if Clause 6 is passed, they may actually, Clause 6 may terminate their appointment to the Land Claims Court. So Clause 7 just provides that those judges that are already appointed to the Land Claims Court will remain as judges of the Land Claims Court. Clauses 8, 9, and 10 then delete sections 23, 26, and 26A as those matters are already covered in the new Clause 6. Clauses 11, 12, and 13 are consequential amendments. They just amend the cutoff date for lodging a claim. Clause 13B requires that the minister must consider factors affecting feasibility for restoration when settling a land claim in terms of Section 42D. The same factors are taken into account by the court when it is the court that deals, that processes a land claim. Section 13C is a technical amendment that provides for the extension of the minister's powers of delegation. Every section that gives powers to the minister has within that section a clause providing for delegation. In Section 42 Big E of the Act, that clause is not included. So currently, when the minister delegates powers to acquire land which are contained in Section 42E, we have to rely on another piece of legislation, which is the Land Administration Act of 1995, which empowers the minister to delegate any power in any piece of legislation. We just, with 13C, want to clean up that Section 42 Big E. Now, in terms of implications at an organizational level for the commission that processes claims and administrative capacity, particularly for the lodgement of the new claims. We have established already 14 lodgement sites that are located across South Africa. This will be the first phase. The second phase will then see lodgement of claims taking place in 52 offices across the country. The commission will employ an additional 304 staff members. 112 posts are in the process of being filled for the first phase, where lodgement will take place in 14 lodgement sites. Now, there are some provinces that are very big, like the Northern Cape, the Eastern Cape, KZN, and many others that are very big. And our offices, in as much as within the 14, we have tried to make sure that we will be accessible. We are going to have mobile units that are going to go and reach even the remote parts of the country for the lodgement process. We are engaging other government departments, municipalities, to see how we can actually try and convert every municipal office into a site for lodging a claim. We've got a youth program in the department, the National Rural Youth Service Corps. We've got 14,400 participants in that program, and they are going to assist in our communication campaign. The capacity then for processing claims, we're engaging DPSA on that, and we've entered into partnerships with research institutions that are going to assist us in the research of the new claims. In terms of communication, we have developed a comprehensive communication plan with GCIS. There will be a citizen's manual, which is a pamphlet that tells a person how to lodge a claim, who qualifies, etc. That will be translated into the official languages, into Braille, and into the main languages that are spoken by the Khoi and San communities. The youth that participate in our youth program will assist in the distribution of that manual. Community development workers, municipalities, and other stakeholders will also assist in the distribution of that manual. Now, in terms of consultations, as we conclude, that were undertaken, there were initially consultations before the bill, provincial workshops and the national workshops with 1,296 delegates. After the bill was approved by Cabinet for purposes of consultation, we had 75 consultative workshops throughout the country. We also received 70 written submissions from individuals and organizations. All of their inputs were taken into account into the final bill that was introduced in the National Assembly. The Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and Land Reform in the National Assembly held public hearings in two districts in each of the provinces, and there was also a national hearings which was convened here in Parliament. The districts where the Portfolio Committee held its consultations were not the same as the districts that we visited, so that we could cover a wider audience and different people. Attendance in parliamentary public hearings was very good. Written and oral representations were made and collected, evaluated, and they were taken into account in the bill that is being tabled here today. So we are of the view that a sufficient consultation has been done by the department and by the Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and Land Reform. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm going to give the honourable members to do the clarities and the question. But before that, let me take this opportunity to welcome another delegate from the Free State. Am I right? Special delegate from the Free State, also Honourable Mangunyana. I also welcome you. And also there's a researcher from Gauteng I also welcome you this meeting. Before that, I've got some one question or two. You talk about the you're going to employ 304, but you didn't say what qualification did you need on those people, or we're going to take anyone in this post. I don't know. And other thing, I've got an interest with in this opening of this legislation. When we are going out from the oversight, there's an outcry said that they didn't receive their claims. Did you finish the last batch of the claimants, and that now you are going to open another one? Are you going to meet this again? Because in the last one you didn't meet it. Thank you. Honorable
West. Thank you, Chair. I see we got lots of free staters here. We got the full cheetah rugby team here today. That's good. Chair, I must just reiterate a few things here. And the department are fully aware this bill has gone through the National Assembly. From my party's standpoint, just give me a few minutes to say the Democratic Alliance supports the reopening of the restitution claims on the basis that justice should not be denied as a result of poor communication and processes on the part of the state prior to the 1998 deadline. However, the DA support, my party support for the Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill, was conditional on certain aspects that required amendment in order to ensure a process that is orderly, fair and transparent. In particular, our support for the bill was conditional on the following, quickly, an intensive communication process that ensures that all those with a legitimate right to claim are aware of the process and the deadlines involved. Secondly, a limited claim window during which claims can be lodged. Thirdly, persons who did not meet the 1998 claim deadline need to show good cause why their claim should be considered eligible in the reopened claim window. Fourthly, the claim verification process being managed by an independent body appointed through a competitive bidding system. Firstly, land claims commissioners being nominated and appointed through a parliamentary procedure rather than the minister. Sixth, both claimants and landowners receiving state-funded legal assistance as opposed to just claimants at the moment, if necessary, to challenge matters through the land claims court. Seven, the necessary funding being made available in the medium-term expenditure framework before the window be reopened. And lastly, setting a six-year deadline from the closure of the claims window for the settlement of all claims. The DA also proposed measures that ensure that the productive farmland remains productive and that the principle of willing buyer, willing seller is upheld. When these amendments were rejected, that's my party, withdrew the support for this bill, and I think the department are fully aware of that. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Wes. I think you must forward your presentation to the department and also to us. Is anyone wants a clarity from the honourable members? If none, I think I've said prior that your responses must be in writing, and it must reach us on Monday before 12 o'clock. Must be in our 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock before in our offices. Thank you very much. I think I must proceed to the Department of Environmental Affairs. National Environmental Management Laws, Third Amendment Bill, B26, B2013, Section 76.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. In accordance with your instructions, Honourable Chair, I'm going to try and just do the highlights of this presentation. I'm going to skip some of these slides. We just have a slide on acronyms. In terms of the problem statement, if I could just state that at the heart of the problem statement is that it was identified in the Strategy for Sustainable Growth and Meaningful Transformation of the Mining Industry that the fragmentation of licensing mechanisms for the mining sector was a key binding constraint on their global competitiveness. In essence, what we have, Honourable Chair, now I'm going to summarise the slides coming. We've got the current situation in mining is where there's an environmental management program approach under the MPRDA for mining, which is implemented by the Minister responsible for mineral resources. Any related activity to that mining operation is regulated through an environmental impact process through the National Environmental Management Act, which is issued by provinces. Any related waste activity is dealt with under the Waste Act, with hazardous waste being dealt with by the Minister of Environment, and the general waste being dealt with by provinces, and the air quality air emissions licenses are managed through the Air Quality Act and implemented by local governments. So we've got a very fragmented system. In 2006 to 2008, this particular issue was discussed between the Ministers of Mineral Resources and the Minister responsible for Water and Environment. And in terms of the constitutional imperative for cooperative governance, the Ministers developed a cooperative agreement to align, streamline, and integrate these fragmented authorization processes in order to enable sustainable development of our mineral resources which will help with job creation, sustainable economic growth, and so on. So what the agreement actually outlines is what we entitle the One Environmental System for Mining, where in fact all environment-related aspects would be regulated through environmental law, the National Environmental Management Act, the Water Act, Air Quality Act, and the Waste Act, and all the environmental provisions in the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act would be repealed. In this instance, the Minister responsible for Environment would set the regulatory framework and norms and standards, but the Minister responsible for Mineral Resources would implement these provisions and issue the authorizations, while the Minister for Environmental Affairs would in fact become the appeal authority. So the Minister of Mineral Resources would implement the environmental legislation, and the Minister of Environment would become the appeal authority. In terms of affecting this agreement, we must note there were two stages. The first set of amendments was adopted by National Assembly and the NCOP in 2008, which aligned the National Environmental Management Environmental Impact Assessment Procedure with the MPRDA Environmental Management Program Procedure, and repealed the program procedure. This agreement came into effect in June 2013, and it became very obvious that further alignments were needed, in particular to include water, waste, and air in the cooperative governance agreement. And in effect, this bill that stands before you deals with the refinement of the first set of amendments passed in 2008, as well as ensuring that it includes the waste process. In terms of the water, aspect, if I could just get to that. In essence, the National Water Act is not a Section 76 Act, and the committee, the Portfolio Committee, has put together a committee bill which ensures that the processes related to the issuing of water use licenses and the appeal processes against those decisions are aligned with this agreement, which is contained within the Section 76 bill, just to ensure that we include the water authorized licensing process within this one environmental system. That's the process of bringing the water into alignment with this agreement. If I could just perhaps move to the amendments in summary. Clause 1 deals with amendments to definitions. In essence, there's a refinement of the definition of an applicant where we have removed any applicant that intends to apply is not an applicant, as it was in the previous, and we've put the issue of what triggers an environmental authorization into the regulation process. In essence, the experience is that any application would trigger environmental authorizations, whether or not the Minister of Mineral Resources even accepts that application in the current definition. So in order to give the Minister of Mineral Resources some time, some 14 days, to consider whether the application for a mining operation would be acceptable or not, this process is now going to be put into regulations. The further definitions, in essence, the bill makes provision for the Minister of Mineral Resources to appoint environmental mineral resource inspectors. It's got to do with the capacity, building capacity of the Minister of Mineral Resources to implement the environmental legislation. The other change that has been made in the bill is that it's not an area-based set of authorizations. This is an activity-based. So in the previous act, the expression was exploration area, mining area, production area, prospecting area. And these technical amendments have been made to the text throughout the bill to say exploration activity, mining activity, production activity, and so on. So these are technical amendments to the definitions. The final amendment to the definition is on financial provision, and really what this does is broaden the scope and types of financial instruments that could be used in the financial provision for managing impacts post closure of or at closure of a mining operation and post closure. So we've included insurance, bank guarantee, trust funds, or cash in that definition. In clause 2, Chair and Honourable Members, the first part of this clause to section 24(5)(b) really is providing for the formulation of regulations for mining waste or mining residue deposits and or residue stockpiles. And once again, the technical amendments of moving from an area-based approach to an activity-based approach have been made. There's an insertion where we're requiring minimum information requirements to be published up front by the Minister of Environmental Affairs to make it easier for the applicants up front to know what minimum information requirements would be required of them in the authorization process. The other amendments deal with process. Basically, it places amendments to replace the environmental management program report process of the MPRDA with the environmental authorization process of the National Environmental Management Act. It provides for the environmental authorizations to be issued before the mining right is issued. It provides for the trigger for environmental authorizations being the acceptance of the application by the Minister of Mineral Resources. And in this way, it ensures that the different regulatory processes for water, air, waste, and environmental impact management are parallel processes, not one running after the other. So these regulatory processes run in parallel to ensure the efficiency and within a reasonable time frame. Clause 3 focuses on the minister responsible for mineral resources being appointed as the competent authority in the case of a mining activity, and it provides for a safeguard process if the minister responsible for mineral resources is for some reason unable to process environmental authorization application, the Minister of Environmental Affairs can facilitate and assist and support the Minister of Mineral Resources in ensuring that the timeframes are met. In clause 4, the competent authority it makes provision for any competent authority, which now includes the Minister of Mineral Resources, to agree with other regulatory authorities to issue an integrated permit. So it could be that the Minister of Mineral Resources could agree with the Minister of Water to integrate the water use license process into the environmental authorization process. So there would be one piece of paper reflecting both authorizations. It includes the provision for the mining operator to submit an environmental management plan or program. So during operation of the mine, there is a plan and procedure for managing environmental impacts. And that environmental management program contains the measures regulating responsibility for any environmental damage, pollution, including the acid mine drainage issue, the issue of polluted and extraneous water, which emanates from the mining activities. In terms of Clause 5 to Section 24N of the National Environmental Management, in essence, this strengthens provisions regulating environmental damage through the Environmental Management Program. And once again, dealing with the issue of acid mine drainage, strengthening those provisions. So the amendments in summary, Chair, are this clause clearly states that any person or the person that is issued with the environmental authorization is responsible for environmental damage both during the operation, at closure, and beyond closure. It then extends that to through the Companies Act or the Close Corporation Act, placing the directors jointly and severally liable for these impacts. Clause 6, Chair, amends Section 24O through the insertion of a new subsection where the minister responsible for mineral resources must consult with other organs of state, and must do that through make that request to the other organs of state through registered mail. Clause 6 requires a 30-day period for consultation with other organs of state, and the existing Regional Mining Development Committee does not now play a role in the decision-making process as it did in the MPRDA and the original NEMA amendments. Clause 7, Chair, makes provision for an annual assessment of the environmental liability that arises from the mining operation. The annual audit report being submitted to the minister responsible for mineral resources on the adequacy of that financial provision. And then it empowers the minister responsible for mineral resources to retain a portion of that financial provision in respect of latent or any other impacts that might happen after closure of the mine, including acid mine drainage issue. Clause 8 amends Section 24R, where the the right or the responsibility for any environmental liability or damage or degradation remains with the holder or the holder of an order, old order right, or the owner of any works. Notwithstanding the fact that a closure certificate may have been issued. Clause 9 inserts a new section to clarify that the mining waste or residue stockpiles and residue deposits will be managed by the Waste Act. In Clause 10, it empowers the Director General of Mineral Resources to issue directives in terms of the National Environmental Management Act. So it empowers the Minister of Mineral Resources to do follow-up enforcement, monitoring, compliance monitoring and enforcement activities in terms of environmental law. It deals with the appointment of mineral resource inspectors by the Minister of Mineral Resources with the same powers as the environmental management inspectors in respect of the activities that they are dealing with. There's a set of amendments which relate to any complainant alleging that the Minister of Mineral Resources has not complied with the timeframes or the procedures outlined in the Act to approach the Minister of Environmental Affairs to facilitate any resolutions as may be required in that related to that complaint. Clause 13 amends Section 42. Which in essence relates to the delegation of powers and duties. Clause 14 amends Section 43. This begins to deal with the appeal authority where the Minister of Environmental Affairs is appointed as the appeal authority on any decision taken, environmental authorization issued by the Minister of Mineral, responsible for mineral resources. It ensures that authorization is suspended in the light of an appeal process. It provides for the lodging of the appeal against any directive issued within 30 days of receiving that directive, and tightens up that time frame so that the process can't be delayed by ongoing internal appeal processes. Clause 15 amends Section 44, which relates to the Minister's power to make, Minister of Environmental Affairs' power to make regulations, and inserted regulations on the assessment and determination of environmental liability, auditing and reporting, any amendments to the financial provision, and other matters related to the financial provision. Clause 16 deals with condonation or any extension of time frames. And in essence, it's a very strict, restrictive condonation process which limits the opportunity for appellants to delay the process through applications for condonation and extension of time frames. So just to be very strict about the time frames which are agreed to. Section 47CB continues with the extension and condonations and outlines the exceptional circumstances and sets the time frames to 30 days. It deals with the factors for the Minister that the Minister of Mineral Resources must take into account when considering the request for condonation, and limits the time periods for which a condonation can be given, up to a period equal to or the time period initially allowed for that step. Amendments to Clause 17 amends Section 50A, and which really sets out the substance of the agreement, the cooperative governance agreement, which this Act brings into effect, and requires that there be concurrence between the Minister responsible for environmental affairs, water affairs, and mineral resources in any process that amends the substance of the cooperative governance agreement, and requires that amendment, any proposed amendment to that, or that would have an impact on that agreement, to be tabled to Parliament for them to be able to express their views on the proposals prior to giving effect to that. Clause 18 really just begins amendments now not to the National Environmental Management Act itself, but to the Waste Act in summary. And it begins with the insertion of the definitions of residue deposits and residue stockpiles into the definitions of the Waste Act. Clause 19 removes the previous exclusion of residue deposits and stockpiles from the purview of the Waste Act. Clause 20 enables the Minister responsible for Environment to prohibit the granting of a waste management license in a particular area, geographic area, mining area, for an example, if it's necessary to for the protection of the environment. Clause 21 is where the minister responsible for mineral resources is recognized as the licensing authority for the mining activity in relation to waste, and may issue a waste license in that area. Clause 22, sorry, Chair, makes provision for the management of the mining waste, the residue deposits and stockpiles, and restricts the ability of any person to deposit residue stockpiles or residue deposits on a site which is not included in the environmental management plan of the original authorization, environmental authorization. Clause 23 creates an offence around the creation of a mining waste dump or residue deposit, residue stockpile in any area that is not identified in the environmental management program. Clause 25 allows the Minister of Mineral Resources to delegate the function. Clause 26 now moves to the amendments brought to the 2008 Act. So the further refinement of the 2008 Act, which was the first set of amendments related to this cooperation agreement, and really just fine-tunes that agreement in relation to the timeframes and process of the appeal process lodged in terms of Section 96 of the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Development Act, where appeals prior to the coming into the effect of this act would be finalized in terms of that act. So it's really technical. So clauses 27 to 29 make amendments to prevent this act coming into effect after, prevent the any implementation after the coming into effect of this act. It's really a technical amendment to prevent confusion between or in the time frames as to when this act comes into effect and when things must be processed in terms of the previous act. And it brings this NEMLA bill into effect 3 months after the date of publication by the President in the act. Chair, I'm not going to go through the impact of the amendments, but what I would like to show you, in essence, what the agreement does is it reduces the time frames, which can be up to 4 years for a mining activity, to get the authorizations within a period of 300 days. If an appeal is lodged, a further 90 days on top of the 300 days is provided for, which is a substantive improvement in the process, and these efficiencies are brought about by aligning the different regulatory processes. The MPRDA, originally an MPRDA process would happen, that would then trigger another set of EIA processes by the province, which would in turn trigger a water use license application, which in turn would trigger an air emission license. So you had these regulatory processes going one after the other. Now they're all running in parallel, and they're strictly confined within time frames. In essence, these amendments to the time frames will be translated into into subordinate legislation through the publication of regulations. At the moment, we have draft amendments to the environmental impact assessment regulations, which are we have a current process of drafting the financial provision regulations, the mining closure regulations, the management of the residue deposits and stockpiles, amendments to the appeals regulation to make provision for this, and exemption regulations to make provision for this cooperative agreement. So these are all regulations currently being drafted in anticipation of this bill being enacted by Parliament. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the briefing. I'll give my honourable members to get the clarities, and if there are some questions, I think the debater will respond in writing also. Honourable West.
Thank you, Chair, and once again, thanks to the Department for your presentation. It's quite lengthy. Just a brief comment here, that my party, DA, does not agree with the unique legal framework for mines whereby the Minister of Mineral Resources is a competent authority for granting environmental authorizations for mines. Attempts to bring the environmental authorization of mines under the competency of the Minister of Environmental Affairs date back to 2008, but have repeatedly been opposed by the Department of Mineral Resources. There is no logical argument why mines should be treated different from other developments. Recent experience has revealed that the environmental competencies of the Department of Mineral Resources are considerably weaker than those of the Department of Environmental Affairs. Despite under existing law, the competent authority for environmental authorization of mines being the Minister of Mineral Resources, there are nevertheless various other components of mine development that still require approval from the Minister of Environmental Affairs. This creates confusion and is another reason why there should be a single competent authority. At the very least, the Minister of Environmental Affairs must be the appeal authority for environmental authorizations granted by the Minister of Mineral Resources. That the DA still supports legislative amendments to bring the environmental authorizations under the sole competency of the Minister of Environmental Affairs. Some of these questions, however, have been partially addressed by the various amendments, and we therefore support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable West. We will hand over this written submission to us and also to the department. Is there anyone? I've got some clarities. Okay, if none, I'll proceed to briefing also by the Department of Environmental Affairs. Management Waste Amendment Bill B32B 2013, also Section 76.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. I'll be presenting the amendments to the Waste Management Act, and while we're getting the presentation loaded, I'll take your point also, Chair, to basically provide some overview and some key areas of the amendments, and I'll try and summarize as well. Chair, the basic premise in us pursuing these amendments is based on the fact that we feel that there needs to be announcements to the legislative and regulatory framework to improve waste management in South Africa. There have been many challenges, and I'll summarize some of them going forward. And secondly, to create an enabling provisions to catalyze and stimulate the recycling economy in South Africa, and to provide much-needed institutional capacity for the mainstreaming of what we call industry and integrated waste management plans, to provide much-needed capacity at the municipal level to implement aspects of the Waste Management Act, and also to create very innovative economic instruments to stimulate the recycling economy in South Africa. What we know is that South Africa in many areas regarding the challenges of waste needs a lot of improvement. We have shown and did some studies that show that there is a potential of a recycling economy in South Africa, as much as 50 billion rand with the potential to create about 10,000 jobs per annum. So essentially, Chair, we're looking at the transformation of the waste sector to harmonize legislation in the area of institutional capacity, regulatory reform, and the creation of viable economic instruments to streamline implementation of various plans. And so we're essentially looking at very minor amendments, Chair. And if you look at this one slide that shows us in comparison to other countries of the world where we only recycle about 10% of our waste, where others recycle up to about 65% of waste. So there's an enormous potential for us to create a recycling economy in South Africa, in the same way protect the environment, clean up the environment, and at the same time provide for much-needed jobs in South Africa. So, Chair, going through the challenges, we feel that the policy and regulatory framework needs to be enhanced. There's been call from stakeholders, including industry and NGOs, for more regulatory and policy certainty. There's been call for more capacity for implementation. There's been call for increasing recycling infrastructure in South Africa. And there's been a call for basically improving capacity for implementation. Chair, so going through the aspects that need the areas that actually we are amending. Firstly, in terms of institutional capacity, we have amended legislation for the introduction of what we call a Waste Management Bureau to basically support the implementation of integrated and industry waste management plans to enhance this capacity in South Africa, to fast-track the implementation of a recycling industry. And I think there's been many calls for why this is taking so long, and most of the time the problem is capacity. So the Waste Management Bureau is going to provide for specialist capacity to fast-track these plans and really get us fast going on a transition to a recycling economy. And it has a sound basis environmentally, economically, and the social justification for that to happen. So in doing that, Chair, we had to harmonize some minor definitions. We provide for a comprehensive list of waste that says really what waste is and what waste is not. And so it reduces some of the ambiguity that we were faced with. It provides for more streamlined processing of integrated and industry waste management plans between the different spheres of government, and also provides for a very innovative funding regime for industry waste management plans, which really sees a marked improvement in how we fund the recycling industry. So going forward, some of the amendments really talk to some definitions where we are deleting some definitions, moving them further down into new schedule. We delete the definition of byproduct by really bolstering the definition of waste better and create more certainty. At the same time, unlock the potential for more waste streams, unlock the potential for jobs from the waste sector, and really enable the industry to be innovative and creative on how they recycle waste. So for more recyclable products, more markets for recyclable goods, and those kinds of things. Really, this is in the area of definitions, another definition of recovery and reuse to really streamline this and make it easier for people to understand and easier for them to do business in the recycling industry. We provide for a very comprehensive, simpler definition of waste to remove ambiguity. And in so doing, we also make it create some provisions for the minister to exclude waste, for it to exempt certain processes around waste streams as well. And essentially, when we look at the new definition of waste, we provide clarity and certainty. I said there's less ambiguity, the providing for the exclusion, a comprehensive list, a better regulatory mechanism for reuse, recycling, and recovery of waste streams, and to create much more opportunities to promote the recycling economy in South Africa. There is an amendment to Clause 2 that amends Section 4 of the Waste Act to include the disposal of animal carcasses, and this has been an area that we think that needs improvement, where we're getting a lot of this type of waste ending up in landfill sites and so forth, and we want to create more capacity and mandate around addressing this problem. Then, Chair, we go on to other amendments where we clarify mandates and streamline the powers around integrated waste management plans so that we don't create duplication. At the same time, we look at how these integrated waste management plans fit firmly in the integrated development planning system within the municipalities and within the provinces, and again to get better alignment within the planning regime for waste management amongst the spheres of government in South Africa. We then provide for a better pricing regime, the creation of a pricing strategy, and really here, Chair, it's to correct a market failure. And some of you may know that, you know, the reason why we have waste in the country, the reason why people can kick around a piece of plastic or paper, it's because it has little value. By us correcting the market failure, getting the right price on recyclable goods, we feel that it needs a pricing strategy, a comprehensive pricing strategy, and working in concurrence with the National Treasury, we'll put forward a pricing strategy supported by a money bill through Parliament, and with that, we hope that this will stimulate the recycling economy immensely and create much-needed jobs in the country. So with the pricing strategy comes waste management charges that will be used and dispersed to industry and organizations to fund waste management plans. And really, these slides talk to how these waste management charges will be created, how they'll be implemented, and how they will be monitored going forward. And to give you one example, many of you know about plastic bags. We pay a levy on plastic bags. It's recycled through Treasury back to the department for some initiatives, and it's in a similar kind of regime that we see these economic instruments working around funding of industry waste management plans going forward. I did speak about the money bill, and I think I'll just go on then to the Waste Management Bureau. This is a very innovative institutional mechanism that's been supported within the sector and the department and organs of state in terms of how we could fast-track various ideals and things we've been talking about in government for a long time, but obviously there's always the issue of capacity. So the Bureau will create much-needed capacity, specialist capacity, to fast-track the implementation of these plans. It will be used to monitor the plans, manage disbursement of incentives and funds. It will also function as an implementing agency for other functions that the department may want it to perform, and it will provide the specialist expertise and support that will be needed. And some of them include the development of waste management plans and support of that, development of tools, instruments, processes, systems, develop norms and standards, but work in a very fast, efficient, and effective manner in managing waste streams in South Africa. Then the second last slide, Chair, is basically in terms of transitional arrangements we have for some of our existing waste management plans, which are very effective to date, and at the same time, like the tire industry plan, we're saying that it will be brought into the bigger scheme of industry waste management plans, into the bigger scheme of better funding incentives, and so there will be a transitional period that's provided for alignment of that with the pricing strategy and so forth. And so it's a period of 6 months that we will provide in terms of this transitional arrangement for the commencement from the commencement of this act for these plans to be regularized and so forth. And essentially, Chair, that's the end of the presentation. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. This is a very short and straight briefing. I'll give the honourable members, honourable West.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the department on the short and crisp presentation. We obviously support the bill. My party does. This national environmental management waste amendment bill. We foresee capacity challenges still in the department, and the limited number of posts remain a concern. But that's all. Thanks.
My question has to do with the plastic bag levy that was imposed way back. You actually mentioned whether has it had the desired impact, or has there been an evaluation of whether it did, had the impact that it was intended? Because just from looking at it, it seems I don't see what impact it has had.
Can you respond?
Thanks, Chair, and thanks for that observation. Yeah, Honourable Member, we have done assessment studies of that, and we have like very, very startling photographs of what it was, the before and after pictures, and we can share that with you. But if you look at across the country, you used to drive along freeways and used to see plastic bags littering fences around farmways and freeways and in cities. We don't have plastic in terms of that type of litter as it used to be. The plastic bag regulations have definitely made an impact, and we have the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications, NRCS, together with the South African Bureau of Standards that monitor the impact of that, and they actually develop the norms and standards for that. But I can assure you, that maybe you get depressed with the other waste paper and things that you see around that we want to address as well. But in terms of plastic, we have studies that confirm really there's been a marked improvement since the implementation of the plastic bag levy.
Because the other part of it is that with these big businesses, Checkers, whatever. Are they not now seeing the plastic bag levy as a revenue stream? Because the original intention was that the money so collected would be put back into the waste management. Now, I don't know whether these checkers and so on, are they not taking that now as some kind of revenue stream for them?
If I can respond, the way it works, Honourable Member, is that levy, the checkers, Woolworths and Pick and Pay and all charge for that plastic bag, that is collected through the national fiscus, through the South African Revenue Service System. And none of that money goes back to checkers and Pick and Pay and all of that. I can assure you, it goes back to Treasury. And in fact, what we've really created around these amendments is a way of us as the environmental sector getting more and more funds from Treasury for and improving waste management in South Africa. So the Bureau, the industry waste management plans, the integrated waste management plans, the creation of capacity is really to say to Treasury, we need more money to improve waste management in South Africa. Now, as you know, Treasury does not ring-fence money. But now you'll have to create the mechanisms institutionally, say that we need capacity. We've got so many plans to fund. We want to clean up South Africa. We want to clean up certain sectors, you know, and certain waste streams. And for Treasury, they say, well, give us the plan. Give us the institutional design. How are you going to do it? So essentially, that is what we've done now with these amendments to get more and more of that revenue that comes from plastic bags, from other kinds of environmental taxes, and really redirect them into the waste management area, to recycling and creation of incentives to fund all these plans and capacity in the country.
Another
breath. Just as an aside, the plastic bag, of course, used to be our national flower. It's like a carbon tax that's going to be introduced, but I know I heard from our Minister for Finance that it will only be introduced later. But isn't there also recycling exercises going to start for vehicle tyres, motor-used tyres, or is that already in on the operation?
I'll do the tyres. Thanks to you, Chair. Yeah, in fact, the tyre industry, for the waste plan for tyres has already been in effect from about June last year. In fact, I think the company that's actually managing that, Redisa, is also here in the house today. But it's been quite an effective mechanism, you know, to get all of that tyres recycled. It's just that we're sitting with a huge backlog. Something like about 65 million tons of tyres stockpiled in various places all over the country. So it's taking a while for that to get going, but it's happening. So it's a similar kind of approach we want to adopt for the other waste streams. But it is a success story already. The carbon tax, I'm not sure if Alphonse tackled that one.
Thank you, Chair. Just on the carbon tax, as you're aware, Minister Gordon announced that the carbon tax would be, implementation date would be delayed till the next financial year. The purpose of that is to ensure alignment of the carbon tax with other climate change and emission reduction initiatives. As you're aware, the climate change response policy has set the end of this year as the date for imposing desired emission reduction objectives on identified sectors. And what you don't want to do is to have a double jeopardy on those sectors which have. So the carbon tax must be complementary with the other measures. So it doesn't, a particular sector is not being subject to a double burden, both a tax burden as well as an emission reduction burden, investment burden. And then there's questions around where does that revenue go? How does that revenue generated by the carbon tax recycle? Does it recycle back into basic services, funding of basic services? Does it? What proportion of that revenue fund recycles into incentives and support for industry to reduce their emissions, and so on and so forth? So, there's a from a technical perspective, there's quite a debate as to how to align a wide range of other incentives and measures that you're using to facilitate carbon reduction, emission reductions, with along with or complementary to a carbon tax. So that's the reason, as I understand it, that the Minister Gordon has postponed the implementation date. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the questions and also the responses. I think now this is the end of our meeting, but I will ask the provinces to take note of this because we're waiting for them to give us the dates for the briefings in the provinces. So please, at least if I can, we can get the dates from Monday until at least next week. If we can have the briefings in the provinces, we can be very glad because we want to finish this bill before we finalize, before we do go for recess for the for Parliament, because we're going to rise soon for Parliament. So we want at least to have enough time for these briefings, and also for the consultations in the provinces. Thank you very much. of Free State. I heard that Free State and Gauteng have already indicated about the date. When is the date? 6th and the 7th. So thank you very much for those. Yeah, I will ask the departments, the officials from the departments to prepare their officials to go down to the provinces. But the committee secretary ask, I will email everything to you for the dates. Do you want to say anything else? Oh, okay. All right. So thank you very much. There's a finger lunch that is going to come at about 11 o'clock. So we can wait for it. Those who are in hurry, they can go. But thank you very much for this meeting of Friday. Thank you very much, honorable members and also the officials. The meeting is